So, of course, as I'm getting dressed and getting ready to come, I'm wondering, okay, what's going to make me look thinner? So she doesn't go away. She's still there. And I took a risk and wore horizontal stripes. So, wow, this is very powerful. Every time I come to a convention, I find I have an attention deficit, so I'm over there right now. So I'll start with telling you that I have notes prepared, the dates and the years and how old I was at certain times, and I left it upstairs. So here we go. I was born probably a normal eater, but so I grew up in a upper middle class Jewish family in the suburbs of New York, and it was a safe home in the early years. I was really loved. My mother used to look at me like I was just the apple of her eye. She just had so much pride in me. I was an adorable little kid, and if my friend looks at the pictures, you'll see, I guess it's all relative, but you think it's adorable, but she always thought I was. And at 7 years old, in school, my father worked 7 days a week, so I didn't see him much, and I loved him very much. So I made up a story for show and tell that he took me to Manhattan on the subway and the trains, and we went to the Empire State Building and the Statue of Liberty, and I had the audience mesmerized. They all came up asking me questions about Manhattan. And there was a PTA meeting that night, and the teacher says, "You're so wonderful, now we had this wonderful experience with your husband." She said, "Well, you must have the wrong little girl, because my husband works 7 days a week." So I want to tell another fantastic story in show and tell 2 days later about him taking me somewhere. And the teacher said, "We don't let liars speak in front of the class." And from that day, I was known as the girl who fell off the Empire State Building. And I was a little girl, and I was tormented a lot. These schools were not big in Newark, Long Island, and but I had a good sense of humor. So I would come to school, sometimes with a band-aid on my face. Is this from the fall? But no one would eat with me, and I ate alone in the bathroom. And around 10 and a half, I started to menstruate. I had no idea what it was. I stayed home from being sick that day, and my pajamas got filled, and my mother was on the phone. She said, "Got to get off the phone, Florence. Now you just got a period." I didn't know what it was at all. It was hell for the next, 30, 40 years, you know. I always said, if a man got it, they would have found a cure for it. So I started looking like a 16, 17-year-old at 11, 12 years old. And I remember my mother going from looking at me adoringly to looking at me with disgust. My mother had bulimia. I didn't know this, of course, till many years in recovery. She was fixated on being thin and pretty. Her family was pretty. She was pretty. And that's what she cared about. And she watched me like a hawk when it came to eating food. She misinterpreted, as we often do, my body that was filling out for fat. And before that, she had started giving me enemas. She was a laxative, bulimic, and a restrictor. She might have been vomiting too, I don't know. She started giving me laxatives very early. She would monitor whether or not I was doing what I was supposed to do. That's what she told me. Now, of course, I have doubts. I just think it was part of her obsession. So when she started to look at me with disgust, I can still remember that day. So I'm 71. And I can remember that look on her face the first time I saw it. And that was the beginning of her absolute obsession with the way I looked. And as the years went on, she would say really the most cruel things to me. "No one's going to love you if you're not pretty and thin." This was a regular thing that she would say. "What man is going to want you looking like that? You can't go out of the house looking like that. Put this on." To this day, I have a hard time picking out clothes. She did it for me for so many years that I don't even, to this day, if I get into something that a thin person would wear and looks cute, I'm so excited, like it's just happening for the first time. And she's having people over. I remember this very well. She's having a party. She said, "Oh, you're coming out of your room. I don't want them to see you." I need to tell you, it wasn't that bad. I wasn't fat. I mean, I really was not a big woman, but good. But in her eyes, I wasn't pretty enough. And when she, so around the time I got my period, my nose started growing. So I had my father's Jimmy Durante nose on my face. And that she was not going to tolerate. So at 13, she took me for plastic surgery. And the doctor said to wait till she was 14. And I had my nose fixed. It wasn't bad because I was being called a lot of names because of my nose. So I was really happy to do it. But at that time, they came out with liquid silicone. Some of you might remember this whole onset of silicone. And the doctor said, because my nose had healed unevenly, he wants to put an injection of liquid silicone into my nose. She jumped on me. She was a very modern woman. We only ate food out of cans and some cooked meals. When they came out with frozen dinners, that was the panacea for her. But she was so distorted, like what mother would say to a doctor, yes, stick some chemicals in her face. And I had an allergic reaction and had to go to, the silicone traveled across my face, and I had 7 more operations on my face. So, in between there were fun times, and I need to say, I still feel like I was a happy kid for a while. Then, the last thing, she was adoring. Those diet pills were amazing. My room was always clean. But I had the only Jewish mother in the New York tri-state area who delighted when her daughter would not eat. If I was eating and enjoying my food, she took the food away from me. She was really a very sick woman who I now can say I've had a lot of compassion for her over the years, but it doesn't alleviate the cruelty that also came to her towards me. So I was being bullied at school, and I was coming home to being bullied at home. Or ignored. Or rejected. And then she's in the hospital, I don't know what she had, a hysterectomy maybe, and I came to visit, I put on a dress that she bought for me. I hated this dress. It was scratchy, and it was shirtwaist dress, yes. Never liked them. None of the popular girls wore shirtwaist dresses, I'm just saying. And I wore this dress that she got me, and I walked to the door of her room, and she was in a room with 4 other women or 3 other women, and she looked at me with disgust and horrified, and she told my father to get me out of there. She didn't want these people to see me. So I did not grow up with a sense that I was ever pretty enough. But oddly enough, I did have a sense of being good enough. So how that worked out, I don't know. I think I just came in with a sense of that. And over the years, so I became pretty addicted to the amphetamines, water pills, laxatives. You know, amphetamines make you constipated. Laxatives. Sleeping pills. And that started at 13, 14. And went on until 30, till, I don't know, see, it was all written down on a piece of paper, like how old I was and what year, I don't know, 1983. Anyone a math wizard in here? You could figure it out. I'm not. And it just accelerated. The self-obsession, how I looked, how my body looked, what I was going to wear. So when I was thin, I felt fat. When I was fat, I felt I pretended to be thin so I could get out of the house. By the time I hit bottom, I was so depressed that I couldn't even leave the house. And I had gone from maybe 110 pounds to 225, 250 pounds. So I'm going to zoom ahead to go to college at 18, meeting the man I was going to marry and divorce at 19. And still dealing with, you know, of course, the eating disorder, getting doctors near the college who would give me the pills, starving a lot. I love to starve. What an accomplishment that was, not to eat for a day. You would think I wrote a book. That's how good I felt about not eating for a day or 2 days. I didn't eat for 30 days once and passed out behind the wheel of my car. Car crashed into a wall. I came out unscathed. I believe I've been protected my whole life. I really do. I have almost died a few times more from this illness. So so this was during the time of the Vietnam War was going to be starting. We were desegregating places. The Black Panthers were around. We were in a New York school. We were pretty liberal-minded and political. We marched. We went to rallies. We did all of that stuff, my ex-husband and I. We got married about 6 years later because we wanted to have a baby. Okay, so this is a hard story, so hopefully I get through it. I got pregnant right away. I carried for 10 months. I gained about 60 pounds because I wasn't taking diet pills anymore. I wasn't doing any of that stuff. I was eating super healthy. Read a book on how to eat healthy when you're pregnant, did all that stuff, but I always did it to excess. And when I went into labor, before I went into labor, I knew I was over. This was in a Port Jervis, New York, a little podunk town in upstate New York in the Catskills. I went to this doctor because in that hospital, they let the father stay in the room with you when you have the baby. In those days, they really didn't do that kind of stuff. And I begged them to give me a C-section. I told them something was wrong. They said, put your books away. We're the doctors. We know what we're doing. I begged them again. I kept dragging my husband day after day. Please get them to, something's really wrong. They let me go a whole month over to 10 months and left me in labor for 64 hours. And my body became his coffin. So, and they gave me a C-section then. I sometimes say if I had thought about it, I would have taken a knife to my own body and taken him out. But of course, it didn't enter my mind. Until the first time I heard this horrible story on the news, I said, why didn't I think of that? So nobody talked about it. My whole family was devastated. My aunts and uncles, everyone was devastated. My mother was pretty good to me while I was pregnant, even though she couldn't look at me. And nobody talked. So I didn't have to be numb from eating to not express my feelings. We just didn't talk about our feelings, unless it was laughter or yelling, a lot of yelling. No violence, physical violence, but the emotional violence was bad. So my eating disorder really took off after that. Got pretty, pretty darn sick. And 2 years later, I had been on way excess amphetamines, like way more than you're supposed to take. Tons of laxatives. I couldn't even control myself to plan when I was going to have to use the bathroom because it happened in the car. Because my body just wasn't going to be regulated anymore. And my appendix ruptured. And I almost died from that. Now, they said it was one of the worst cases the hospital had seen. And I believe personally it was from all the abuse I was doing to my intestines. But, you know, there's no proof of that. You have to have proof to say something happened. So intuitively, I just felt like that had happened. But it wasn't enough to stop me. As soon as I recovered, I was back on the pills, back on the laxatives. My mother got Alzheimer's disease around that age, in my early 30s. She saw me hugging my father once, and he comes pulling off him by my hair and says, get your own man. That's what Alzheimer's can do to somebody. But who knows? If that wasn't even a subconscious thing she was going through when I was growing up, I mean, I don't know what was going on with my poor mother. The good first stuff about my mother that I got from was she loved animals. She was very kind to animals. She rescued. We had an injured swan we took care of. We lived on a lake. We had turtles that we took, that they would crawl up to our home. One was injured. She made a whole big bath for the turtle. If my brother or I found a dog, we'd call her up and say, we found a dog. She'd throw a robe on and her coat and come get the dog, and we had a dog. So she had a lot of good qualities. If you were bleeding in front of her, she was a great healer. If you were emotionally in pain, she was not very in tune with anything or with herself. My mother's mother committed suicide in 1941 when she was pregnant with my brother, and I don't think my mother got over that. She had a fight with her mother that morning, who was living with her, and she went to work, and when she came home, they found out that her 80-year-old mother had thrown herself from a window. So my mother suffered with terrible depression. I got it, too. I got the depression, too. Whether it's because of the disease, the abuse, or it just comes down through the ethers from our parents and our ancestors, because her mother was obviously very depressed also, and obese, as were my aunts. My mother was never going to be obese. She was a glamorous, pretty woman. So anyway, she didn't get out of bed for at least a month after I lost the baby. My husband and I never talked about it. And I got sick, very sick. I couldn't move. My back would go out. I kept running fevers. I wasn't sick like you could take me to the hospital. But what happened is my friend came, picked me up off the bathroom floor one day because I had a back spasm because my husband had had it with me and he went to work. And she took me to therapy. I cannot tell you my story without telling you what I do. It was my first time in therapy and the first time I cried about my son dying. And still nobody talked about it except my friend. By the way, this friend who rescued me that day taught me bulimia. She'd get sick after every meal. She'd go throw up after dinner, and I'd say, what's wrong with you? You've got to go to the doctor. Something's wrong with you. And she said, no, I throw up so I won't have to gain weight. And I said, what a brilliant idea. Okay, so normal people do not think that throwing up is a brilliant idea. But I still didn't know how sick I was. I was in denial about how much I was eating. People would say to me when I was obese, how did you get this big? I don't know. I only eat one meal a day. I have no idea. I was in total denial about how much food I was taking in. But you don't get to be, 60 pounds overweight or 70 pounds overweight not eating, or eating the right foods even. Normal people go up and down 5 pounds, maybe 10, but my brother was a normal eater. Stuff would go bad in his house. I would go in there to raid his house, and I wouldn't even eat the stuff because it had been there so long that he was forgetting was there. I don't know about forgetting if that stuff is there. I forget everything else, but put something in my house that I'm not supposed to eat, and I will remember all the time that it's there and how much of it is left. So I got divorced. He was cheating. Threw him out. And then I started drinking at bars and picking up men and being very thin and falling in love every time I slept with someone, thinking this was it. This was the next one. Sometimes I saw them again. Most of the time I saw them again. Only to get, excuse me, I hope I'm not offending anyone, but to get laid. I'm actually restraining myself from saying a few other things. What would happen is I was floating in the wake of my parents' country home, and I was thinking, this was not what my life was supposed to be. My son dies, my husband leaves. Nothing was happening the way I was. It was, my mother doesn't know me anymore, which actually wasn't a bad thing at that time. And I had a spontaneous spiritual awakening. And it wasn't a flashback on one of my LSD trips. It really was. I got to see that I was a part of something really amazing, the universe. I had an experience of just being a part of nature, one with nature. And I always grew up loving nature and relating to nature. Another gift from my parents, because they always took us to the mountains on the weekends and the summers. And I knew there was something greater than me. No idea what it was, but my spirits were lifted in that moment. Like, I knew I had a purpose. I didn't know what it was yet, but I had a purpose. And after that, my husband and I had moved to Los Angeles, is where we got divorced. And I met some people who were amazing people, healers, meditators, really spiritual people. Some were a little far out, even for me, and I can get pretty far out. But I learned about things that I'd never realized before, that there's something more than just concrete thinking. This is the way it is, this is the way it isn't. You have to do it this way, you don't do it that way. There's this big place filled with all kinds of energy, and I became a healer. I had natural healing abilities, and I became a healer. And I was also working as a counselor in a mental health setting. So anyway, when I hit bottom, I was in my house. I didn't let the dogs in the public. I only let them out in the back because I didn't want anyone to see me. I had gotten up to way over 200 pounds, and I was sitting in the living room eating, because I had been eating in the bedroom with the television, but I thought if I move the television, maybe I won't eat so much. Yeah, that works. And I was in the living room. I must have eaten enough for 10 people. And I had loved that shopping run before the binge. I mean, that's a big part of the eating thing, was planning what I'm going to go get and then walking up and down those aisles and saying, okay, I'll try that. I'll try to get to the cash register. You think this is enough for 15 people? I'm having a party tomorrow night. But that night, July 5th, I started crying as I was binging. I had just gone out to my backyard to the nectarine tree with a big pail. I always say, I told this story a million times, but I always say, that tree quaked in fear as I approached it. I ripped off every nectarine. Give me something sweet. Give me something I like. And there's no end to how much I could eat. And I was binging away on nectarines. It was the dessert from what I had just eaten earlier. And I couldn't eat. I was holding this half-eaten nectarine, and I started crying and crying. Maybe it's the first time in I don't know how long. What's wrong with me? Why can't I stop eating? It's the first time I ever asked that question. I always thought I couldn't stop eating because I wasn't a strong woman. My father used to say to me, some of the things in life you cannot control. This is something you can control. But it wasn't anything I could control. And I heard a voice in Los Angeles. You hear voices in Los Angeles. And it said, you're very sick. It was a long time ago. I remember it like yesterday because it was so... I didn't even question that I'm hearing voices. I mean, I'm a therapist, and I didn't even question that I was hearing voices. And I said, I don't know what to do. What do I do? Go to OA. Overeaters Anonymous. And it said Overeaters Anonymous. And I had gone a couple of times before, but I left because you people are crazy. I mean, God this and God that, and I'm powerless, and I have to turn everything over, and I'm not powerless. Turn over what? You know? But that night, I crawled into a room, and the woman speaking had to be at least 100 pounds overweight. And she said, I'm so-and-so. I've been in the program a year. I've lost 100 pounds. Now, I didn't go in to lose weight. I really didn't. I wasn't asking, how can I lose weight? What's wrong with me for being so fat? I wanted to go in because I couldn't stop eating. But when I heard that, I knew she had controlled her eating. Those are the words I used at the time. And I was struck abstinent. You guys said, jump. I went, how high? What do you want me to do? I got a sponsor. I got on, in those days they had really very rigid food plans. I loved it. You know, I felt great. This was better than being on amphetamines, you know. This was like, you know, I could eat some things, but there wasn't much to eat in a lot of these food plans. And that was a problem, because that restrictive kind of eating accelerated the eating disorder for when I relapsed a few years later. So what happened is I met a spiritual teacher after I had a year of recovery, and I worked this program. I went to a meeting a day, in those days, 90 and 90. It's like, see, some head shaking. Yeah, you know, 90 and 90 in those days. And I did 90 and 90. And I called people, and I sponsored, and I did the steps. But I still didn't admit everything. You want to call them my food to someone and tell them if I ate all of it or didn't eat all of it? And I slipped and slided a bit towards the second year. But I met a spiritual teacher, and I was searching. I was searching for something. I walked the paths of Eastern paths. I had already been meditating. And I went to India, and I lived in India for 6 months the first time I went. And I stayed in recovery pretty well. And I went with another OA member who I met at that first meeting. And we helped each other stay as abstinent as we could, given that we didn't have our own food. We had to eat wherever we were taken. But when she and I both wanted to sample the delicacies, we would take each other's hand and just, like, walk out of the room. And that was pretty life-changing, because people are starving everywhere you go in India. They don't have what we have. We didn't have hot water where we stayed in any of the places. They would boil the water in pots and bring us little buckets of hot water so we could wash ourselves. So my life pretty much changed. I never complained about anything here in the first world after that, and I still don't. You know, people in my building are crazy if the hot water is off for a day. I said, go to myself, go boil some water. Take the ice out of the refrigerator and, you know, go boil some water. So I've gone back to India several times after that, so I came to maybe a year and a half of living there at different times, traveling all through, meeting all kinds of wonderful, amazing people. And when I came back, there was a job in the paper that said eating disorders therapist for Rader Institute. Some of you remember Rader Institute was the first major eating disorders company to go national. So my friend, who came back from India with me, said, this is a perfect job for you. I said, are you serious? I have this thing. I have to talk about it all the time. I'm listening to stories 10 times a week. I don't want to do this work. She cuts it out. She puts it on the table. So I had 3 dogs who didn't leave anything where it was supposed to be. And I threw it in the garbage, and they went into the garbage someday. And then by the front door, I was going to apply to another mental health institution. There was the ad on the floor by the front door. I said, okay. Okay, I'll do it. And I went, and they hired me right away as a counselor. And I've been in the field of treating eating disorders ever since. This is how much my higher power loves me. There's no way I could have stayed in recovery if I did not do this work. And I found my purpose. My purpose is to help us. I became clinical director at Rader Institute. They transferred me from Los Angeles to run 5 clinical programs in Florida and Georgia. And I had my first relapse there. When I moved, I didn't know anybody. I had a sick dog. She was old and she was dying. And I was very lonely. The program was a fraction of the strength that Los Angeles had. And I started slipping and sliding. I was putting on weight. I said, I know, if I don't do something, I'm not going to be able to keep my job. I can't keep this job and not walk the talk. And I was driving home, and so there's a drive-in fast food place. And they have that white cold stuff that's really, was really good, not to me anymore. And I'm praying, please don't let me buy it. Please don't let me get it. And I'm crying, please don't let me get it. I pull in, and I'm crying, and I'm still pulling in. And I'm praying, and I'm still pulling in. And I get up to the window. We didn't have those microphones in those days. God, I feel like I sound like my grandmother. Way back in the day. So I asked for it, and the woman said, so sorry, ma'am. The machine just broke 10 minutes ago. So whoever your higher power is, don't underestimate the power of that being. And I got back in recovery after that. That was the saving grace from that. And So I'm terrible with money. Even in private practice, people would cry, they don't have money, and I would see them for free. Of course, they came in with these fabulous nails, and their hair was all done, but there was no money to pay me. But I didn't care. I didn't care. I knew that whoever came to me, I had to say. I'm a little more discriminating now because I'm 71 and I have no money. So I charge for what I do now. But I also help a lot of people. And I went from that kind of work into working and being a clinical director in a substance abuse treatment program in Barrow County when Radio Institute closed. I was contacted by someone who was starting an eating disorders program in Miami, and they asked me to come and help them get the program started. It was my favorite job. So I've worked with thousands and thousands of us. We would have census of up to 80 people, and primarily women. And all having suffered horribly from this disease and suffered horribly from the abuse. Oh, don't cry, honey. We're all getting better. It's a good thing. And what I want to say is I was very mindful when I was eating. I was mindful about everything I brought to eat. I lost consciousness during eating. I don't mean I blacked out, but it was just, you know, eating. I went into what I call a negative stasis state, where I had no feelings. I couldn't function. I thought I was sated, but I never really felt sated. But when I got into what recovery has given me is my life. It's helped me explore what my spiritual path is, which is very strong. I have a very, very intimate, communicative relationship with my higher power. I feel I'm not married again. I always wanted to get married again, but I never did get married again. I mean, I'm still not giving up hope, but I've become much more discriminating in my old age. And it helped me think clearly. I learned how to think. I learned how to feel. I learned how to express my feelings. I learned how to talk to people. I learned how to live in my heart. I learned how to be in the moment. I learned how to eat and concentrate, work on eating my food. I don't eat when I'm listening to music. I don't eat when I'm watching television. I watch, I listen, I pay attention. I do portion sizes. I didn't count calories. I mean, I had enough experience to do that. For someone who can't count, it was really a difficult thing to try to do, was count calories. And I learned about portion sizes. So I had become vegetarian in the 70s. My ex-husband and I lived next to a farm, and we got to know a lot of the animals, and we both decided we're not going to eat meat anymore because we saw them as sentient beings, and they have feelings, and they just want to live and be happy. And we got friendly with a cow, and we got friendly with goats, and he wouldn't let me take any of them home, which I really wanted to, but he didn't let me. So we went vegetarian, and about 16 years ago, I learned some more. I'm an ethical vegan, so I became vegan when I found out some more things about the meat industry and the dairy industry. And I used to have selective compassion. Now the compassion is universal. If you're breathing, I have compassion. And I don't want to cause harm. And if I hadn't had this program to teach me how to be spiritual and loving and compassionate and speak my truth and be authentic about who I am and like myself, and I don't have to go outside with makeup all the time, and everything doesn't have, nothing can have, nothing could have a wrinkle back in the days, you know. I haven't have ironed anything in, is that the time I'm done? To 45 minutes? Oh my gosh, I want to lead you in a mindful meditation. That's what this was going to be about. I totally lost track. I tell you, I should. All right, 5 minutes. We're going to do a mindful meditation.
Sorry.
So this is what to do. I want you to close your eyes, please, and take a breath. Let the back of your chair support you. Keep your spine as straight as you can. I want you to bring your consciousness from your brain down into your heart. You're just going to be imagining some things now. And follow your breath. Notice yourself breathing in slowly, gently. Notice breathing out. Count for three breaths as you relax more and more. I want you to bring your awareness into your body, but ask your heart, where is the weakness in your recovery? Do you have deception? Are you not following your plan? Are you rationalizing what you do? And let yourself really feel and connect to that. And tell yourself, I deserve to be in recovery. I deserve to be peaceful. I deserve to be happy. And now ask your heart, what is it you need to do to strengthen your recovery? Pick one thing. And make a determination to do that one thing, one day at a time. Maybe do some writing on it. Be brave. Look at your resistance. Take a deep breath. There's something I just want to say. If I can do this as a willfully young girl with lots of opinions, you can do this. If you're struggling, you can do this. Be brave. Even if you don't have a higher power, make one up. Your higher power doesn't care what you call it, if it's loving. We are not separate from our higher power. That higher power lives in us. That is the truth of who we are in there. And we can find that truth. It's already there. We're good. We're compassionate. We're wise. We're loving. We're a little crazy, and that's okay. You're not separate from your higher power. You can't be. Doesn't matter whether you're paying attention or not. You can't be separate. And that was very comforting for me to realize. Because that's how I learned about unconditional love. And that's what everyone can know about. Thank you very much.